such an explosion of information that we are now really in a quandary about how much we need, we expect a physician to know, and how much, how do we make the separation now between the body of knowledge which we expect from a graduate student in biochemistry and from what we expect in a physician. When I was a student in my biochemistry course, we didn't have to learn metabolic cycles. The Krebs cycle had not been discovered, and there was this thing called an Emden-Meyerhoff pathway, which was one small abbreviated pathway. One of the basic compounds in metabolism, glucose-6-phosphate, the Emden ester, had only been described 3 years or 4 years before I started biochemistry. And we were told to not to read anything about amino acids and proteins, because that was the most important part of medicine, and they were going to lecture to us in great detail about that. But things like purines and pyrimidines, which had something to do with gout, perhaps, we better read that, because they wouldn't be able to get around to it now, it turns out. Of course, the nucleic acid is the keystone of everything we think about now, so, and that's all purine and pyrimidine. So that was how our teachers gave us the wrong bet, but we make those commitments. I was taught syphilis, three weeks in pathology, 3 weeks in medicine, 3 weeks in neurology, 3 weeks in psychiatry, 3 weeks in dermatology. Syphilis, I knew all about syphilis coming out of my ears. Nobody, these kids aren't even going to see a case of tertiary syphilis. It's disappeared. We used to see them walking up and down First Avenue all the time. And it was a big clinical problem. Now I trust that AIDS will disappear in the same way, although I don't think they spend as much time with that disease as we did with syphilis. So there are, in the early days, we as a new school, we said to ourselves, well, what shall we teach? And of course, we found ourselves thrown back on, we'll teach what we know. And that's always dangerous, because then you... But the students are good. They stimulate you to look beyond last year's lecture. And
you're getting good graduate students?
Well...
Are you talking undergraduate?
No, I'm talking about undergraduate medical students.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And there are... these unused opportunities that we have here that I was particularly anxious that you have a record of, so that someone who might someday look back and say, yeah, that's what they should have been doing, and maybe they did, we'll go ahead and do it. And that is, here we are between two great laboratories, and one in biomedical science at Cold Spring Harbor, mm-hmm. and the other in natural sciences at Brookhaven, with extraordinary capabilities, just Brookhaven alone, in terms of analytic capability, in terms of modalities for treatment, is unexcelled. They have a very good biology department. Medicine is uncertain because the support has been uncertain. The old Atomic Energy Commission didn't quite not know what to do with its responsibility for biomedical research in that area. They knew they ought to be doing something in radiobiology and in the peaceful use of the atom. But they were always run by physicists, and they had no real sense that there were great things that could be done in a national laboratory with the mission of a national laboratory. That is, big science that the universities couldn't afford.
Right.
And I think they fought it always. In the Department of Energy, when it finally took over, has not had an outstanding record in the understanding and continuing support of biomedical research. The hospital is 44 beds. They are closed down now, mothballed.
Really?
And 44 beds would make an incredible clinical research center. The only place would be larger than in that would be the NIH clinical center in Bethesda, The hospital of the Rockefeller University has 33 beds. And we haven't been able to commit to it yet. And the human resources that would be needed to set that up, nor have we had any promise of support from the Department of Energy. Now we're trying to, in the early days, it did great things, Brookhaven did, and it was because they had no limits on what approaches could be.
FAR was the first one.
Yes, and FAR and Victor Bond at that time were the ones who introduced the use radioactive thymidine as a tracer. Gene Cronkite made signal contributions there. Coccius, the discovery of L-DOPA for treatment of Parkinsonism, and Lou Dahl, who knew all about hypertension and established the fact that there were genetic bases for hypertension, but that there were also environmental factors like salt intake that affected it. Those were days, but then they were exploiting Brookhaven at a time when the universities, immediately after the war, had no money and no laboratory facilities. Then as the universities acquired these, being out of the medical mainstream, it seemed, discouraged their recruitment of younger people. And there's been no continuity. So the department has deteriorated.
Who's head now?
Head of medicine now is Chanana, Arjun Chanana, who was an Indian surgeon who came to work with Cronkite and has been there as long as anybody, I guess, now.
Is there any contact between Stony Brook and Brookhaven?
Well, there's considerable contact. I'm chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Associated University.
AUI?
Yeah. And
Board of Trustees of the Medical Center?
No, the whole AUI.
The whole thing? Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, in other words, Stony Brook is now in there with the other nine universities?
Well, John Marburger and Jerry Schubel say, we want to be one of the universities. Now, there can't be a founding university because the place is founded. But the other universities have no statutory responsibility for that place. It's a private corporation.
Yes.
They provided two individuals in each of those universities.
Yeah.
Now it's broken down, and that some people are from, there are a lot of, there are more trustees at large, and they'll be satisfied with one trustee from each of the founding universities, so to speak. But when I say to Bob Hughes, who's the executive president, that they want to be, he says, well, how much more can they be in than having you here as president of the board, as chairman of the board of trustees? Mm-hmm. Well, I think the administration here would like to see something written down.
Yeah.
But
how long have you been chairman?
I'm in my second year now.
Second year, I see.
I've been on the Board of Trustees since 1980, I think, or before, 78, uh-huh. Something like that.
Well, I think it's a logical move that there should be some administrative connection between the two institutions.
Well, I'm sure that when I step down, they will be only too happy to have some continuing. Of course, the Stony Brook is the major user of the physics facility as well. And we're establishing closer contacts now. We're setting up a unit for radiation therapy there. They're building us a building.
Is that right?
We're providing the professional staffing of it and the machine, the linear accelerator that will be used for treatment there. But they also have other opportunities for us. They have proton beams that we can use. And they have this, the National Synchrotron Light Source, which is an incredible facility, too, for both diagnosis and...
For diagnosis, really? Rose therapy?
Well, the diagnosis is very neat. For instance, this is a very powerful X-ray source they have in the synchrotron light source. And also, they can tune the X-ray through various wavelengths. So if they Right now, to do visualize coronary arteries, you have to go right in and put a catheter in the coronary artery. It's an invasive procedure. You don't have to do that for the cerebral arteries because you can immobilize the head and take an x-ray with a standard x-ray machine, but the heart is beating this way. And you need very good contrast, and you need to be able to stop the motion, so to speak. So you need this powerful x-ray source that they have. You give an intravenous injection, then, and you get enough contrast, and you get enough, and in fact, the x-ray is powerful enough, like taking a picture of it with a lot of light, so that you can stop the motion. That's the kind of diagnostic capability that has. So that looks exciting. And then I took the new dean, Jordan Cohn, through there. He was very excited about what he saw. He said, gee, it's like F.A.O. Schwartz for adults. All these beautiful toys, neutron activation, neutron capture, neutron activation, whole body counting. And neutron capture, we're still working on new ways of treating brain tumors with neutrons.
No longer boron?
Well, it's still boron, still compounds, boron? But new compounds, hopefully.
I see.
That will improve the therapeutic ratio. Mm-hmm. So Brookhaven, I think, would be important to nurture that and to enlarge it and... I would hope that we could do that within the next few years. Cold Spring Harbor is another opportunity. We always have someone on the Board of Trustees there. Now, I think the current representative is Sid Strickland from the Department of Pharmacology, who's a very good fellow. They think very highly of him. And we take part in the summer courses, and we have ever since Joe... professor of first professor of microbiology.
Okay.
And he was followed by Arnie Levine, who was on the Board of Trustees. He left for Princeton. Strickland became our representative, and that's. That has sort of limited interest now. With the taking part in the Human Genome Project, which Watson is the head of, I'm sure that will.
What does that mean, the human genome?
It means eventually working out the sequence of bases of these particular chemical compounds in the 100,000 genes that carry all the characteristics of humans and make you different from me. And you the same as me in some part. And understanding how these certain arrangements will predispose to disease and others will protect against disease.
Do chromosomes have the same number of genes, or are they?
No, there are different numbers, and the chromosomes are of different size, and the numbers of genes are different, but the total mass, the whole human genome, means all the chromosomes, and not only determining what sequence of the bases are, but which chromosome they're located on and which ones are next to one another.
Yeah.
And that will be an important descriptor of disease. Now, the argument as to whether we need all that now at a cost of $4 or $5 billion is what's plaguing people, I guess. So I think that's going to be very exciting. And I feel almost like Moses can't cross over into the promised land. But it's going to be good to watch.
I've been interested in the physical basis of intellectual characteristics ever since I was first a dean and having to deal with people in the different disciplines, because it was a matter of amazement and something to be understood, if possible. Why it is that certain people, and sometimes
generation after generation in the same family, like, let's say, the Goldhabers, are willing to focus on a certain set of problems, a certain particular discipline, all their life. And why it is that some of those minds are closed to some disciplines, such as the humanist talking about mathematics, some individuals in the sciences talking about their lack of interest in the structure of society, or in politics, or whatever. I'm sure there's a genetic base to whatever it is that the environment influences.
I think that's true. I think that there never was, even though we know specific causes of disease, like the tubercle bacillus,
yes,
causes tuberculosis, still there are people who get it and people who don't get it, exposed with the same exposure, mm-hmm, same, and those, there are certainly genetic differences that determine that. But whether we all understand them all in that detail is another question. In 1953, April of 1953 was the date when Watson and Crick's hypothesis for the structure of the gene came out, and there was a great deal of excitement in medicine. We learned about it when our people came back from Woods Hole that summer and explained the double helix to us. And there were no limits to what we were going to be able to do now that we had this chemical understanding. And I was in the elevator with a group of students. I remember this like it was yesterday, and we were riding up, and I was explaining to the students with great enthusiasm, because I saw this as this tremendous advance, leap ahead. And in the elevator with us was Otto Lurie. Otto Lurie was the old professor of pharmacology and Nobel Prize winner. And as I lectured to the students, we got up to about the fourth floor, he turned around to me and he said, "Krishna, you will never explain the Budapest String Quartet on the basis of DNA." And everybody laughed. And now I thought to myself, you know, maybe he's wrong. Maybe someday we will be able to explain the Budapest String Quartet in terms of their genes. But I'm sure that will only be part of the explanation, and how they, what's turned on and what's turned off, maybe. Very much a matter of upbringing and environment. But that's all part of the excitement. Now, I think my concern is we get into these things and we get all excited about it and we find ourselves dealing with description at another level. Maybe it's a little closer to the ultimate truth, but not, maybe not. Maybe we're never going to explain certain things. Goodness. How do you explain goodness in terms of DNA? Why? Well, is there a gene for goodness and badness? I don't know.
Yeah. That's difficult. And if you think in terms of the structure of the human individual, I'm interested right now in the structure of the valuer, man the valuer. Not only on the basis of what he feels or knows about his physical needs, not only on the basis of what he has in the way of intellectual interests or the rational side of the mind, but I'm interested in the genetic basis of I'm interested in the question as to how far down into the core of the individual, which we call either the self, or the soul, or the spirit, or the psyche, or the ego, genetics actually goes in its influence. I'm convinced that there are some people who are much more sensitive emotionally, or much more sensitive to beauty, or much more curious and in some ways in tune with the infinite, or whatever is behind the universe, than others. I'm sure that there are some, and I've run into them. Those questions don't interest them at all. They are agnostics, and if they're aggressive, they're atheists. The mind is closed. The same thing for music. Some people are almost infinitely open to music of all kinds. Other people like me can't stand certain kinds of modern music. It's almost as if I'm just not made that way.
Well, that's part of the promise of working out the human genome. Will be the linkages that can be made.
Yes.
Is it possible that the kinds of characteristics you're describing will be reflected in the organization of one's genetic substance? I don't know. I don't think it's ever going to be a problem for us in our time. Mm-hmm. Someone else will have to do that.
Yeah.
But
you think then that there's a real frontier in the genetic composition of humans, not only physical but mental and possibly psychical?
Oh yes, I don't think there's any doubt about that.
It's a real frontier. It's
yes, and it may take a superior race to fully understand this. I mean, there's nothing that says that we're the best that can be.
Right, that's right.
But we are all we have now, and I think that it's always seemed to me that watching the fact that you, with your long association with this place, have remained in contact with it, tended its functions, played a role in the place, is the thing that makes this different from any other kind of business, so to speak. It has a kind of demands a kind of loyalty which people who are retired in other fields do not feel. And I may be projecting myself in the sense that I'm going to be 70 in August and probably will play a lesser and lesser role, and yet I'm sure I will take a major interest always in how this place progresses and how it carries on. And I would hope that the kinds of individuals it will attract may not be the kinds that Ed and I always envisage, but I hope they'll be very sensitive, caring people.
Well, I hope so too. I've got to go and pick up a dolly downstairs at the bottom of the